Look! Over here!
The crowd of pilgrims rushed to Starbo's cave.
It's Bradley Lindstrom. He's been shot dead.
Jake Simmons held a torch close while he and the others bent down to inspect the body.
My Lord in heaven.
Malcolm pushed his way through the crowd.
Bradley, no!
Low-down murdering dog. Some of us ought to go after him.
Pete Watson's comment was met with nods of agreement, but no one moved to form a posse right away.
Where's Callie?
Jake looked around at the gathering of faces, unable to find that of his daughter.
Callie!
Has anybody seen Callie?
Everyone shook their heads in confusion.
Oh, no, no, no!
Every inch of the riverbank was searched, and the cottonwoods, the meadow, the corral. The girl was gone. The moon was high in the sky before the last of the searchers gave up and returned to the fire to report their failure.
Oh, he's got her! That monster took her! He took our baby!
We'll find him. We'll get her back.
Malcolm Lindstrom was already a step ahead, calling for volunteers to go with him and Pete. Every man there volunteered to join the posse, some wounded and not really fit to ride. Malcolm picked 8 of the volunteers.
Get saddled up. We already lost too much time.
Still shaken, but determined to go after his daughter, Jake left Cora in the hands of Raymond Chadwick's wife, Pearl, and hurried to join the posse. There was no clear trail to follow, especially in the dark. But the one they decided the most likely was the one through the cottonwoods to the south. It was the trail cut by Joe Fox when he had left the camp the first time. Since there'd been a bit more traffic over the same tracks from Indians and Joe's horses when he left for good, it would have been difficult for a real tracker to determine if any of the tracks were recent. Out of the trees and onto the broad, treeless plain that rolled toward the distant mountains, they rode, determined men, resolute in their intent to find Starbo and Callie. Unprotected by trees, however, the snow on the open plain had melted during the recent weeks of warm weather. The riders were slowed by the need to inspect the ground more closely for tracks in the darkness of the night. Soon, the posse was broken into smaller groups as men circled about, checking the little isolated patches of old snow in gullies and ravines. Finally, when the moon was sinking behind the mountains, even Jake was forced to admit that they were going in circles and might as well give up.
It ain't that long till daylight. Might as well stay right here till sunup.
We left in a kind of hurry, Jake. We ain't that far from camp as it is, so we might as well go on back and pack in some supplies. We don't know how long this is gonna take. We'll get back on it in the morning, ready to ride to Texas if we have to. I got as much reason to catch that son of a bitch as you do.
I expect you're right.
When Callie awoke, it was to a world of pain and sickness and disappointment to find that she was, in fact, still alive. Moments before she lost consciousness, she had prayed that God would take her soul, but he had not seen fit to end her torment. As she lay there on the ground now, she did not open her eyes, afraid that he would see that she was awake and attack her again. Her body ached with deep bruises all over, as if she'd been trampled under a horse's hooves. Her thighs and knees burned with the pain of muscles stretched beyond their human limits.
Oh!
God damn. Ain't you pretty sad? Well, now, I reckon you learned your first lesson. It don't pay to make me mad. And you're going to get a whooping every time you don't give me what I want. So, get yourself up from there and clean up.
Oh!
He watched her closely as she stumbled to a small stream nearby and dropped to her knees at the water's edge. Raising her head slowly, she turned to gaze across the creek and the trees beyond. How far could she get, she wondered, before he would run her down?
I wish you would try.
Starbo picked his rifle up.
Get your lazy ass over here. You ain't gonna have no picnic just enjoying my company. You're gonna have to work for the pleasure of taking care of my needs.
He waved her over toward the pack mule with his rifle.
Now there's coffee, bacon, and flour and such in them packs. You cook me up some breakfast. You know, like them cakes of pan bread you's always fixing up for that damn half-breed. And let me tell you right now, it better be good. Or I'll whoop you till you can't stand up.
Afraid to do otherwise, she did as she was told. Feeling smug and very satisfied with himself, Starbo watched his captive closely, admiring the slim hips and tidy bottom that he had ogled all the way from Dakota Territory. He smiled when he thought about the taking of that body, violent though it may have been. Haggard and weary, Jake Simmons' face showed the strain of a day searching that yielded no results. The search party had been unsuccessful in picking up any recent tracks that might give them some place to start looking. They were stopped near a small stream watering their horses.
It's a waste of time, Jake. I mean, I'll go out again tomorrow if you want, but we ain't got a notion where to look. He's got away clean. That's just all there is to it.
Raymond's right. We ain't doing no good out here. I think the only chance we got to find Callie is Joe Fox, and I don't know if he can track him. But he's the best chance you've got.
I don't know if he would agree to do it, Malcolm.
Why wouldn't he? He's been willing to help with everything we asked him to do.
I don't know. But besides, who knows where he is?
I might. He told Raymond and me that he's got a camp about 2 days' ride from here near a waterfall. If you'll give me a minute, I'll think of the name of that creek.
Otter Creek. It was Otter Creek.
That's right, it was. I figure all we got to do is find that creek and follow it up the mountain till we find the waterfall. I'll bet old Templeton at the trading post knows where Otter Creek is.
The other members of the posse all agreed to the plan. Tired of riding all day with no hope of results, they were in favor of any plan to get him out of the saddle, knowing there was no need for them all to look for Joe.
I reckon we ain't got no choice but to try.
I'll go with you. Me and Pete will. We'll find him if he's still there. We'll head out first thing in the morning.
The next morning, Malcolm Lindstrom sat on his horse at the mouth of a wide creek, studying the rough map that Templeton had sketched for him, then comparing it with the features of the terrain.
This has got to be it. There's that knob of firs at the foot of the hill and the big rock that looks like a turtle on the other side of the creek.
Pete Watson nudged his horse up beside Malcolm's to take a look at the map himself.
Looks right to me.
Then he took a long look up at the towering mountain beyond the hill, its peak still covered with snow.
That sure appears like the kind of country he favors, don't it? I hope to hell this camp ain't all the way up that mountain.
Well, let's get started. Maybe we'll find him before dark, if he's still there.
The passage along the creek was easy enough until they followed it beyond the small foothills and up through a forest so thick with firs that it was as dark as night. Winding their way through trees, around boulders, and smaller rocks, they found it difficult to follow the creek bank, making it necessary to swing wide around rock formations to search for the creek again. The higher they climbed, the more difficult it became. And soon, they were forced to dismount and lead their horses. About halfway up the mountain, the creek narrowed as it rushed through a narrow flume formed by solid rock. They paused at a deep pool at the bottom of the flume to let the horses drink. Malcolm began to have doubts, wondering whether they had followed the wrong creek. Scanning the steep slope above him, he could see no sign of a waterfall. He turned to Pete and Jake to express his concern.
I don't know if we've wasted half a day or not, but standing here looking up this mountain, I don't see how there could be a waterfall up above us.
I don't know. Maybe if we get up to the top of this chute, we can see better.
They decided to leave the horses there at the bottom of the flume, thinking it too difficult to make the steep climb while trying to lead them. After a half-hour climb up the rocky face of the mountain, they finally reached the top of the flume.
Damn!
Malcolm could see now that the stream had disappeared. Looking back a few dozen yards, they discovered the reason. A knee-high cavern in the rocks from which the water flowed. The stream was underground above them.
Well, there ain't no damn waterfall on this mountain, at least not on this stream.
They stood and scratched their heads for a few minutes while they discussed it. But it was the opinion of all three that there was no sense in continuing to climb higher and higher up the wrong mountain. It took them some time to retrace their path, but eventually they reached the pool at the bottom of the flume again.
This is the second time I found your horses with nobody watching them. Are you looking for me?
They were startled to find a buckskin-clad figure squatting on his heels on top of the largest of the rocks that formed one side of the natural basin.
Joe Fox.
We're hoping you'll help us find Callie. She's been took by that devil Starbow. I know there's probably some hard feelings between me and you, but I'm hoping you'll do the Christian thing and set him aside and help us track Starbow. We've done tried to track him, but we lost him. It takes somebody like an Injun or something to track him, because he ain't left one track, and you're the only one we know of. And if you need me to say I'm sorry for what I said to you before, hell, I'll say it.
Take it easy, Jake. He ain't said no yet.
There was only a flicker in the mountain man's eye to register the distress he felt inside when he was told of the abduction of Callie Simmons. Malcolm feared at first that Joe was going to deny their plea for help, for he saw no expression of concern on the man's face.
I must take care of my horses, then we can go.
God bless you. Cora and I both thank you.
Joe paused to study the worried man for a moment, his face revealing no emotion.
I do it for Callie. Come on.
Joe led him into the trees. After a walk of about 10 minutes, they came to a clearing in the forest with grass and several springs bubbling from the earth. The horses were grazing in the mountain meadow, and off to one corner of the clearing, they saw his camp and the ashes of a campfire.
We'll help you carry your possibles and drive your horses.
No need. I'll take all I need on the paint. I'll leave the horses. They'll take care of themselves till I come back for them. I'll be traveling light.
I thought you told me your camp was near a waterfall.
It is. We just came from it.
Puzzled by the answer before it struck him, Malcolm understood then. He had pictured a typical waterfall pouring over a cliff, while Joe considered the water rushing down the flume a waterfall.
Oh yeah, I reckon we did it that.
Malcolm thought he, Pete, and Jake had pushed their horses pretty hard on their search upriver for Joe. But their trek was a casual stroll compared to the pace set by the solemn mountain man on the return trip. Seeming never to tire, the Paint Indian pony set a demanding pace for the horses ridden by the three men following Joe. Before the first night's camp, first one and then another dropped behind until they were strung out over a quarter of a mile. With dusk approaching, Joe had ridden back and gathered the men to make camp, and had tersely informed them that he'd be leaving before sunup in the morning. It was a simple statement, but the men understood that he was telling them that he would not wait for them if they weren't ready to leave. It was early afternoon when Joe and three weary companions arrived at the caves by the river. And the entire camp turned out to greet them. Among them, Cora Simmons stood anxiously waiting, her eyes red from crying and lack of sleep. Jake stepped down and caught her in his arms.
God bless you, Joe.
Joe nodded.
There's a bunch of us ready to ride with you, Joe.
Joe took a moment to look over the crowd before responding.
I'll be going alone, Raymond. If you want to help, I'll be obliged if you could spare me some coffee beans. I'm about out.
Why, sure. We'd be more than happy to give you some coffee, but you ain't gonna need some help. I mean, what if you catch up with that devil?
I'll be going alone.
All right. I expect you'll be leaving first thing in the morning. We followed some tracks out of those trees to the south, figured he'd be heading in that direction, but they petered out after he reached the high ground beyond that mesa.
I'll be going now, as soon as I rest my horse.
It'll be dark in 2 hours.
2 hours might make a lot of difference to your daughter.
He nodded toward the mountains to the east of the valley.
Did your posse ride down the valley over that way?
No, it didn't make much sense to go that way. There's nothing to the east but mountains and Injuns. That's where them Grovant came from. We figured Starbow would hightail it down the valley back the way we first came.
Joe nodded again, and without a word of goodbye, he stepped up on the paint and rode out of the little clearing and the line of caves carved out of the bluffs. They watched him as he crossed the narrow creek on the far side of the clearing, but instead of turning to the right through the stand of cottonwoods, he guided the paint to the east.
Well, where's he going? I just told him Starbow had to have gone the other way.
I expect he knows what he's doing. He always does.
The tracks were old, but still there, between the creek and a shallow draw to the east. They were the tracks left by the war party that hit the settlers' camp. Joe dismounted and knelt to examine them. They verified the recount of the raid he'd been given by Malcolm and Pete. Unshod horses, their hoof prints going in both directions, told him that the Grovant had come and gone down the same draw. He was looking for prints from a shod horse, figuring that Starbow would have been smart enough to try to mix his tracks with the plethora of hoof prints. It was a gamble on his part to hope to find tracks this long after the abduction, but he had to bet that Starbow took this route. There wasn't a chance in hell that he'd be able to pick out any tracks after the posse had obliterated those through the cottonwoods, so he had no choice. The paint munched casually on the short grass beside the trail, following slowly along behind Joe as he moved down toward the draw, his eyes searching, his fingertips feeling the hardened ridges of the prints. The tracks were too old. He moved forward, searching and feeling again. Suddenly, he stopped. The faint outline and sharp marks of a horseshoe that had been invisible up until then now stood out in his vision like a shining sign. With some feeling of confidence that Starbow had fled in this direction, he continued to search the path before him. A second print, then another, and another appeared as he trained his eyes to focus on the shod images and ignore those of the Indian ponies. The puzzle to be solved now was how far Starbow remained on this trail before he changed directions. Joe knew that the brutal bully had turned off somewhere before reaching the mountains, lest he find himself a guest of the Grovant. He continued the painfully slow process until all at once, there were no more prints, only those of the unshod horses. He had missed the turnoff. He looked back the way he had come, searching for a likely spot to leave the trail. He decided on a shallow stream a few yards back and returned to examine the area more closely. There was no sign that Starbow had left the trail, but Joe could find no shod prints on the east side of the creek. So he felt confident that his man turned up the stream. In the saddle again, he guided the paint into the water and slow walked him up the middle of the fast flowing water while he scanned the banks carefully. He could find no tracks that would indicate a point at which Starbow left the water, but he felt certain that he would have headed upstream. After almost a quarter of a mile, the stream became narrow as it cut a trench through a thick stand of willows and berry bushes. Then something caught his eye. He saw a branch that had recently been broken off. confident again that he had not missed a sign, he pushed on. A little way past the willows, he found what he was looking for. Coming to a small clearing where the stream forked around a sandy spit, a clear set of hoof prints led up the soft dirt of the bank. He didn't have to dismount to read them. Starbo didn't think he had to be careful anymore. Joe followed the tracks out of the water and pulled the paint to a halt in the middle of the clearing. The cold ashes of a fire marked where they had camped. Nearby, he found traces of dried blood in the grass, enough to feel a stab of pain in his gut, but not enough to indicate a slaughter.
She's still alive.
There was no need to scout the clearing more thoroughly. He had the answer to the question he had most sought an answer for. The question to be answered now was, where did they go from here? To find his answer, he began scouting the perimeter of the clearing until he found prints and a uniform pattern leading away to the south. Crossing the stream again, they led him into a dense pine forest, where he lost the trail and proceeded only on instinct and guesswork. With no signs to lead him, he had to rely upon the lay of the land, and which seemed to be the most obvious path down through the pines. The worrisome question kept repeating itself in his mind, even though he tried to suppress it. Tracking this way was too slow. He would never catch up to him before it was too late. Still, there was little choice. Picking up the trail again at the edge of a line of grass-covered, almost treeless hills, he pushed on until darkness forced him to camp.
Huh. Well, you ain't swishing that little tail back and forth like you used to, before you got rolled good and hard.
Sitting in the shade of a tall pine that had somehow managed to grow up through a crack in the huge boulder he was using as a backrest, he made himself comfortable while he watched the battered young girl carry wood for his fire. She'd made an attempt to escape when they had stopped at midday to rest the horses, mistakenly thinking he was not watching her closely when she went to fill the coffee pot. It was a desperate attempt, and she paid a painful price in the form of a beating that left her bleeding and bruised.
Yeah, that's enough firewood for now. You get on over here and cook my supper.
He watched as she dutifully did his bidding. He was gonna miss the pleasure of ravaging her body, but he was about to reach the point where he deemed it time to put her out of her misery. He didn't know the country well enough to be sure, but he figured that he should be reaching some of the mining camps before riding very much farther. Her defensive practice of pretending she was dead when he had his way with her was infuriating to him anyway, like mating with a damn possum. He made up his mind then. One more go round, and he'd cut her throat. Having made the decision that this was to be her last night, he smiled to himself in anticipation of the night's entertainment. The killing promised to be the most enjoyable part to Starbo.
You know, I think I'll let you have a little bit more to eat tonight.
Lost in the moment of anticipating his evening's entertainment, he was suddenly distracted by the girl's movements by the fire. In the process of adding more wood, she abruptly froze, bent over with a sizable limb poised over the flame, but suspended motionless. Something had caught her eye, causing her to stare at the forest beyond the stream. Following the direction of her gaze, he was startled to discover three Indians at the edge of the trees, mounted, silently watching the activities of the girl by the fire. He immediately grabbed his rifle and prepared to fire, but the Indians made no move to attack. Instead, they calmly watched both the white man and woman for what seemed a long time to Starbo as he remained seated by the pine tree, deciding whether to shoot or not. Maybe they were friendly. He didn't know one Indian from another, so he couldn't say what tribe they were. He had heard that the Flatheads and the Kootenai used to live in this part of the Bitter Roots, and they were supposed to be friendly with the white men. Then, remembering the raid by the Grovant, he decided he'd better shoot while he had a sitting target.
Friend!
This is a fact.
Starbow noticed then that two of the Indians were carrying parts of a sizable deer behind them.
Yeah, friend! Come on in, friend!
The Indian who had spoken before held up his hand in a gesture of peace. Then the three split up before slowly riding into the camp, having no doubt learned that some white men were friendly and some were not. Starbow had to smile when he realized they knew his repeating rifle gave him superior firepower, so they had spread out in case he started shooting. Dropping his rifle by his side, he waved them in. Callie backed slowly away from the fire while keeping it between her and the three Indians, frightened by the curious stares of the visitors. The older one, who had spoken before, looked from the girl to the huge man with his rifle held with one hand at his side. He then quickly scanned the camp, making a mental note of the packs before he spoke again.
I am called Grey Wolf. I am Salish. We're friends of the white man. You have coffee? We will trade you some fresh meat for some coffee.
I guess I could let you have a little for a good portion of that meat.
Grey Wolf nodded, then pointed to Callie.
Bear?
What?
Then it struck Starbow that Grey Wolf wondered whether Callie had been attacked by a bear to be so battered and scarred.
Oh, no. She's just a little slow in learning how to behave.
Woman slave?
Never mind the woman. How about that meat? I need most of what you got there.
Coffee.
All right, coffee. Callie, get a double handful of coffee beans from the packs. That one sack's about empty. Put them in that.
When Callie came back with the beans, she gave them to Grey Wolf and immediately stepped away. Grey Wolf looked inside the sack at the small amount of beans and glanced at one of the men standing beside him. The man nodded and took his knife. He sliced off a small portion from the haunch and offered it to Starbow.
Hell, I gotta have a hell of a lot more than that.
More coffee.
I can't spare no more coffee. It'll be a spell until I get to where I can get some more. I need more of that meat you're carrying. Listen, I can't spare any more coffee, but I need all the meat you got there. Maybe we can trade something else for the meat.
We trade you all the meat for the woman.
You're done. That's proper trade.
Callie turned and ran.
Whoa! There she goes! Looks like you're gonna have to run her down.
Callie ran as hard as she could with nothing in her terrified mind but escape. She stumbled as she staggered up a grassy rise toward a pine forest. A dozen steps from the edge of the forest, she was suddenly lifted off the ground by a strong arm wrapped around her waist. Galloping back to the fire, Lame Horse dropped her at Grey Wolf's feet. Driven almost out of her mind with fear, she lay there, knowing it was useless to try to run again. Lame Horse stood over her, while his companions transferred most of their meat to Starbow's horse.
Yeah, good trade.
Starbow stepped back with his rifle ready while the Salish hunters prepared to leave. Tying Callie's hands together, Lame Horse looped a length of rope around her wrist. Holding the free end of the rope, the three visitors departed.
You might have thought I was a little hard on you. You wait till them Injuns get through with you.
Callie tried to brace herself mentally for what she knew was going to happen. With all emotions inside her reduced to shame and sorrow, she had come to perceive her body, even her soul, as nothing more than clay, a lifeless form without past or future, something to be casually used, then thrown away. Even so, she found she was unable to completely will her mind away from the soulful stare of the fearsome warrior. Looking down, avoiding the intense gaze of her savage master, she waited, wanting only to have it over with. Lame Horse did not thrust himself upon her violently, though, as the savage Starbow had done. Instead, he seemed more curious about her person. Intrigued by her sandy hair, he reached out to feel it. He paused and gave her a puzzled look. Then he took a large strand of her hair in his hand, feeling it as if judging the texture of a bolt of cloth. Releasing her hair then, he reached down and caught the hem of her tattered skirt. His reaction was calm and deliberate as he struck her face sharply with the back of his hand. When she lifted her eyes to meet his gaze, it conveyed a message that he would not tolerate disobedience. When he continued his inspection, she no longer resisted, knowing it wouldn't save her. He slowly lifted her skirt and was at once appalled by her torn and blood-encrusted undergarments. Anger sprang from his face then, with no thought of sympathy for the obvious torment the woman had suffered. Instead, he was disgusted, thinking she was dirty. Furious with the thoughts that he'd been cheated, he grabbed a handful of her underwear and ripped it from her body. Casting it upon the ground in revulsion, he took her by the hair and pulled her, stumbling, to the creek they had camped beside. There, she was unceremoniously dumped into the cold, knee-deep water.
Clean.
She was still in the water when Gray Wolf and Two Bears returned with the carcass of a mule deer draped across each horse. Upon seeing the woman in the creek trying to clean herself without exposing too much of her body, Gray Wolf assumed that Lame Horse had sampled the fruits of his slave.
So, are you satisfied with this trade?
I have heard that white women are different between their legs than our women.
All females are the same. Ask Lame Horse, he will tell you.
How should I know? I would not lower myself to lie with her. She is dirty. Not worth the meat I traded her for.
Is that why she's cleaning herself in the creek?
Lame Horse ignored the question.
I'm thinking that maybe we should trail this white man and kill him and take the meat back. I will decide about the woman. And maybe I will kill her and then go after the big ugly white man.
That is one thing we could do. But the white man has the gun that shoots many times. If we can surprise him before he has a chance to do it, then we can kill him. And that would be good. But we are armed with nothing but our bows. We would have to get close to get a shot. And if we did not kill him, it would be like wounding the grizzly bear. With his gun, he might kill one or more of us. We did not ride the war path when we left our village. We meant only to hunt. We have plenty of meat to share. And you have a present for Little Moon.
Unfortunately for Callie, her treatment at the hands of the Salish hunters was little better than that she had experienced while a captive of Starbow, with one exception, for which she was grateful. Although she was occasionally beaten with Lame Horse's bow whenever she displeased him, she was not sexually assaulted. It was ironic that she had Starbow to thank for that. Lame Horse had been so repulsed by the injury she had suffered that left her so scarred and bloody that he lost his lust for her. There were no thoughts of hope for her survival, however, as she trudged along ancient game trails behind the Indians' horses, her wrists rubbed bloody by the rawhide rope that bound her. There were times during the long walk when she felt she could go no farther, and only the promise from Lame Horse that he would kill her if she could not continue caused her to stagger along behind him. The end of each day found her reeling from exhaustion, her feet swollen and bleeding, but she was still ordered to find wood, make the fire, and cook their meat. Finally, after the third full day, she reached the point where she no longer cared if she lived or died. When the three men had eaten their fill, she dropped wearily to the ground beside the fire to try to make a meal for herself out of what was left. Watching her, as he always did, Lame Horse waited until she had picked some morsels of meat from the bones and prepared to eat them.
Get up from there, you lazy bitch, and bring the pawflesh for my horse.
It was the final straw.
Get it yourself, you goddamn dirty savage!
All three men blinked in surprise, astonished to hear her make even the smallest sound. Lame Horse jumped to his feet in a fit of rage and stormed over to the fire, his bow in hand. Accustomed to his beatings now, Callie hugged her knees and rolled up in as small a ball as she could. When Lame Horse paused to take a breath, Callie reached into the campfire and grasped the burning limb. She struck him across the knee. Taken completely off guard and hobbled by the sharp pain in his kneecap, Lame Horse staggered backward. He tripped over his own bow, which had fallen when he was hit in the knee. Lame Horse had no choice but to roll over and over to escape the enraged woman. With no thought toward coming to the aid of their comrade, Two Bears and Gray Wolf found the episode highly entertaining. Lame Horse, however, could find no humor in the humiliating incident. At a safe distance from the crouching demon now, she with her smoking club ready to defend herself, his eyes fairly sparked with indignation.
You are a dead woman. I will carve your liver from your body and feed it to the dogs.
You can go to hell.
Lame Horse drew his long skinning knife from his belt and started toward her again. She backed away, but only a couple of yards to the fire, where she quickly exchanged her smoking timber for another in full flame, clearly prepared to fight to the death.
Wait. The woman has shown great courage. It would be wrong to kill her for fighting for her life.
What you say may be true, but she clearly is too dumb to train. So why waste food and water on her? She is my property, and I no longer want her. So I will kill her.
Let me say this. My wife could make use of this worthless woman. I will give you my white pony for her.
This caused the Lame Horse to pause again. The white mare was a favor to Gray Wolf's, and it would certainly compensate him for his loss of the woman. He replaced his knife in the sheath.
It is agreed, but I think you have been cheated.
Perhaps so.
Callie took another step backward and held her weapon before her when Gray Wolf started to approach her.
Put the limb back in the fire. No one is going to hurt you. You may rest now.
Whether she chose to believe him or not, she wasn't certain. But suddenly, the passionate rage that had sustained her left her body, and with it, the strength to resist. Exhausted, she dropped to her knees, her strength spent, and her mind a dizzy eddy in her brain. She was afraid she was finished. If they chose to kill her, she could no longer resist. Gray Wolf took the burning limb from her hand and threw it in the fire.
We will reach our village tomorrow, before the sun is straight over our heads. Tonight, you can rest.
I think there will be no more trouble from her this night.
Maybe so, but I'm going to bind her hands and feet tightly, just in case she wakes up like a mountain lion again.
Joe Fox jogged along a well-defined game trail, leading his horse behind him. On foot, he could study the ground more closely while still holding to a pace sufficient to rapidly close the distance between him and Starbow. Near a large boulder with a pine tree growing out of its center, he found the remains of a campfire. Joe dropped the paint's reins and let the horse graze in the grass between the rocks while he scouted the campsite. Suddenly, he took a step backward and knelt to examine a track he had almost missed. It was an unshod print, and it was as fresh as the tracks he had followed into the clearing. Moving more slowly now, he scouted farther, finding more and more of the unshod tracks. Starbo had had visitors.
Indians.
Scouting the clearing in a wider circle, he could find no indication of a fight, which caused him to seriously ponder the meeting. It appeared they had peacefully parted company, for he found the same two sets of tracks he had followed from Missoula Mills on the far side of the stream, and they continued to lead southeast toward the mining camps. Taking time to satisfy his curiosity, he scouted back along the stream in an effort to find the trail left by the Indians. In a few minutes' time, he found what he was looking for, a clear trail left by two horses, maybe three. They led off toward the northwest. Satisfied, he turned to continue trailing Starbo when he was stopped cold by the sight of a clear footprint in the soft, dead leaves by the water's edge. Too small to be that of a man, it had a clear shape of a heel, unlike a print a moccasin would leave. His thoughts now spinning in his head like a whirlpool, he followed the trail left by the horses, picking up the tiny print of the girl's shoe wherever the ground was soft enough.
Kali.
He looked long and hard in the direction indicated by the tracks. They led to the northwest, toward the mountains beyond the Missoula Valley. From the footprints he had found, it was obvious to him that Callie was being led like a prisoner. He took a moment then to turn and look in the direction Starbo had gone. He knew in his heart that he could not rest until the score was settled with the cruel murderer and rapist. The knowledge that Callie would still be safely with her family had he simply pulled the trigger when he had Starbo under his rifle still haunted his conscience. There was no decision to be made at this point, however. Starbo would have to wait. He turned his thoughts and his concentration on the trail before him, praying that she could survive until he found her. One day's travel from the Rocky Glen, he came upon a smaller clearing beside a creek and the remains of another campsite. Almost reluctant to go farther, afraid of what he might find, he walked his horse slowly into the clearing, glancing sharply from side to side. Pulling the paint up beside the burnt-out campfire, he dismounted and began to examine the ground around the coals. There was not a great deal of sign to tell him what had happened to Callie that night. A few discarded bones told him that the Indians, a party of three, he now decided, had eaten deer meat for their supper. And while there were signs that a scuffle had taken place near the fire, there was no fresh blood anywhere on the grass or sand, giving him hope that Callie was not involved. A few yards away from the ashes, he found a large piece of cloth that caused him immediate concern. It appeared to be part of a woman's undergarment, and it was covered with blood. But the blood was old and crusted, again giving him hope that it was evidence of an earlier wound and she had not been harmed by her Indian captors. Not permitting himself to dwell upon what might be happening to Callie, he immediately set out to follow the trail again, planning to push on until darkness forced him to stop. If Callie thought her lot had improved when she was traded to Grey Wolf for a horse, she was to be disappointed once more. Grey Wolf himself was not the source of her continued hardship. Credit for that belonged to Bright Basket. As Grey Wolf's first wife, she was his sits-beside-him wife, sitting at his right side in the teepee. His other two wives were Bright Basket's younger sisters, and their positions in the teepee were closer to the door. Bright Basket was not pleased to see the young white girl led into the village by the hunters, and she was quick to express her displeasure to her husband when she found out that the girl was his property.
Why have you brought this coyote pup into my lodge? Are you still so young that you think you need another wife?
Maybe I am so old that I don't need to hear your sharp tongue. I have no need for another wife. I bought her for you to help with your chores.
Huh. Are you complaining that the three women in your teepee do not take care of you properly?
Your rattling makes my head hurt. Lame Horse traded some deer meat to a white man for the woman. Then he decided he didn't want her, so he was going to kill her. She is small, but she can fight like a mountain lion. It would have been a shame to kill her. So now, she is yours to work for you.
Brightbasket marched over to Callie, who had been left to be gaped at by the crowd that had gathered around Grey Wolf's horse. With hands on her hips, Brightbasket walked around the frightened girl, looking her over intently. She noticed the many bruises and scars on the girl's arms and legs.
You must be a lazy slave, or you wouldn't have so many scars. Now that you are mine, you will not be lazy, or I will beat you to death.
She turned to speak to her sisters, who had come to stare at the white slave.
She can gather the wood for the fire. Watch her carefully.
She turned back to Callie.
Go! Collect wood for fire.
Callie didn't move, having no notion what she was being told. Frustrated, Brightbasket grabbed the quirt from Grey Wolf's saddle and set upon the unsuspecting girl. Desperate to save herself from the angry woman, Callie braced herself to fight back, even if it meant her death. She took the sting of the whip on her arms and managed to grab it before Brightbasket could pull it away. It became a tug of war between the battered girl and the larger woman.
Enough!
Disgusted with his wife's jealous reaction to the hostage, Grey Wolf noted the welts and fresh cuts, as well as bleeding from some of her old wounds.
Take her to the river's edge and let her clean herself. Then give her something to eat. If she is better tomorrow, we'll decide what to do with her.
What if she is no better tomorrow?
Then we will kill her.
Satisfied with that answer, Brightbasket's smirk returned to her face.
I'll let her clean herself if she can, but I'll not have the coyote bitch in my teepee. She can sleep outside with the dogs.
After bathing in the river and still dripping wet, Callie was led to Brightbasket's lodge, where she was bound hand and foot, then tied to a small tree with a short length of rope. There she lay in the afternoon sunshine, a curiosity for the children of the village and an object of open scorn by the women. Cramped and cold though she was, she mercifully fell asleep, her mind and body being too tired to remain awake. She was awakened by Brightbasket's sister as she rudely poked her with her toe. Seeing that the captive was not dead, Brightbasket's sister placed some meat on the ground near Callie's face. Then, without bothering to untie her hands, the sister left her to grovel for her supper. As she struggled to inch her way close enough to take some of the food in her mouth, she realized that evening was descending upon the village. It was nothing more than an unconscious thought, for she was past the point of caring whether it was day or night. Hampered by the pain in her jaw, she was forced to eat slowly and carefully, so it was no real competition for the hungry dog.
No! Bring me back my food! No!
Callie rolled over on her side to discover Brightbasket watching her.
You eat with your brother, coyote bitch.
You can go to hell.
Brightbasket drew near and aimed a kick in Callie's stomach. With that, Brightbasket walked away, leaving Callie to suffer in solitude. Callie finally managed to drift off to sleep, only to be awakened once again in the wee hours of the night.
Callie, don't be afraid. It's me. I've come to take you away from here. Callie, do you understand what I'm saying? It's me, Joe.
With eyes wide open now, she nodded rapidly.
Be real quiet. I'm gonna cut you loose, and we gotta get out of here. Can you walk?
Yes.
Good.
Joe finished sawing the rawhide ropes that held her. Then he looked around him at the sleeping Salish village. When he was satisfied that all was still quiet, He lifted her to her feet.
Come. The horses are in that stand of trees near the riverbank.
They quickly gain the cover of the trees.
Can you ride?
I think so.
I think this horse will do fine for you. I stole her from their horses on the other side of the river. I'd rather not have a white one, but this one came over to meet me and acted like she was just waiting for me to come get her. Come on, up you go. We'd best get moving.
Joe had fashioned a bridle and reins from one piece of rope with a couple of half hitches, Indian style.
Sorry, I didn't have time to find a saddle for you.
I don't need a saddle. Let's just get away from here.
Yes, ma'am. We're gonna go for a little swim. Hang on real tight.
Once they reached the other side, he led them straight up the valley, making the best time possible in the darkened night. With the coming of the morning sun, it was apparent to Joe that Callie needed rest and food. Looking around for the best place to stop for a while to let her rest, he slowed the horses to a stop when they came to a small stream winding its way down from a mountain pass high above them.
This'll do. We'll climb up this stream a ways till we get out of sight and high enough to see anybody that might be thinking about following us.
Joe picked the first suitable spot, a small glen where the stream widened to flow over a rocky ledge. It wasn't high enough to give him a view of the valley floor, but it likewise couldn't be easily seen from above. Dismounting, he moved quickly to her side and caught her as she leaned toward him, almost falling from the mare's back.
Easy does it, Kelly.
Thank you. I must look aside.
His heart ached for her and the torment she had obviously suffered. Her arms and legs bore the scars, and bloodstains on her tattered clothes were testimony to the many beatings she had survived.
I'm going to get a fire started to warm you up a little. Then I'll find you something to eat. I've got coffee in my saddlebag. You'll feel a sight better once you get a decent meal in you.
Before long, Joe had a pot of coffee going and was able to kill a squirrel in order to get Callie some fresh meat to replenish her strength.
Do you want some coffee?
I'll have some a little later on.
Joe busied himself with tending the squirrel.
This little feller is about done.
It's not a lot of breakfast for a man your size, is it?
This is all for you. I ain't really hungry. I just wanted some coffee. Guess I ate too much of that jerky.
Will they come after us?
Can't say for sure. Sometimes it's hard to say what an Indian will do, especially a flathead. But I don't reckon they'll be any too happy when they figure out somebody walked right into their camp and took you. We'll be moving on from this spot as soon as you're feeling up to it, just to be safe. I've got to get you back to your folks.
Maybe they've already started for Oregon.
They're not going to start without you. Besides, there's still some snow in the high passes.
Eager to put more distance between them and the Salish warriors he knew would be coming, Joe studied the young woman intensely as she cleaned the bones of the squirrel. He decided that she definitely needed more nourishment than one puny squirrel could give her, but he was afraid to take the time to hunt when still this close to the Salish village. He was sure she also needed time to rest and recover from the horrible ordeal she had undergone. The problem at the present time, however, was that they could ill afford to take the time. In spite of his concern, she insisted that she was ready to ride again after she had eaten. He still had doubts, but he also knew that it was too dangerous to stay where they were. In an effort to make it easier for her, he took his saddle off the paint and placed it on the mare. Although it was no more than an Indian saddle, one he had made, it still gave her more to hold on to. He pulled his rifle from the sling, jumped up on the paint, and with a gentle nudge of his heels, started up toward the ridge above him. Intent upon at least gaining the far side of a line of ridges to the west before stopping again, Joe led Callie along the side of the closest ridge, weaving his way through thick growths of firs, gradually climbing toward the crest. Looking back frequently to see how she was doing, he was met with a determined smile. The forest abounded with deer sign, and at one point he spotted a buck and three does below him on a ledge. It would have been an easy shot, but he was reluctant to use his rifle. He was going to have to kill a deer for Callie's sake, but it would have to be shot with his bow. With the afternoon sun gradually descending, they crossed over the top of the ridge, and with the sun looking directly in his eyes, he started a slow descent, following a stream that appeared to have popped out of a rocky defile. From above, he could see what appeared to be a clearing about halfway down the slope with the stream wending its way through the center. Joe turned to take another look at Callie. There were no longer traces of that determined smile. Instead, she appeared grim and haggard, and he hoped he hadn't pushed her too far.
Halfway down the slope, we'll make our camp and I'll hunt something to eat.
She managed a grateful nod. On this evening, Callie did not volunteer to help set up the camp. After settling her comfortably by a fire, Joe filled his coffee pot in the cold mountain stream and set it to boil at the edge of the flames. When she was settled, he left her, took his bow, and disappeared into the forest. Deer frequented the slope he had camped on. He was sure of that. There was plenty of sign, droppings, tree bark rubbed off, even hoof prints. But there were no deer close around. He figured they had been frightened away by the approach of the two horses and riders. But it mattered little to Callie, because she was sound asleep when he returned to camp. He carefully removed the coffee cup from her fingers and covered her with his own blanket.